Good evening, everybody. It's lovely to see so many people here in the public gallery this evening. Last meeting of the year. My name's Paula Reek, Mayor of Kingborough, and it is my pleasure to welcome everybody here to this meeting on Monday the 19th of December 2022. As I mentioned, we have a packed public gallery this evening, and I'm sure we have many people watching at home on the live stream. Being 5:30pm, I now officially declare this meeting open. I wish to advise that council meetings are recorded and made publicly available on our website, and in accordance with council's policy, I'll ask the Acting General Manager to confirm that the recording has started.
Confirm, Mayor.
Thank you. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of this land, pay respects to elders past and present, and acknowledge today's Tasmanian Aboriginal community. Our attendees this evening are myself, Councillor Reek, Deputy Mayor Councillor Gladewright, Councillor Antoli, Councillor Cordova, Councillor Dean, Councillor Fox, Councillor Midgley, Councillor Richardson, Councillor Street has not joined us yet. Councillor Street has not joined us yet, but we assume he will be here shortly. He might be stuck in traffic. We also have with us from staff the Acting General Manager, Mr. Smee, Chief Financial Officer, Mr. Breen, Director of Environment Development and Community Services, Dr. Fox, the Acting Director of Governance, Recreation and Property Services, Mr. Basham, Manager of Environmental Services, Ms. Quinn, our Coordinator of Building and Plumbing, Mr. DeCrew, Coordinator of Environmental Planning, Ms. Dan Exter, Media and Communications Advisor Ms. Adams, our Communications and Engagement Support Officer Ms. Klein, and our Executive Assistant Mrs. Morton. In closed session, we will also be joined by the Program Manager of Transform Kingston, Mr. Kamet Soglu. We have apologies this evening from Councillor Bain. Moving to page one, confirmation of minutes. The motion is that the minutes of the open session of Council Meeting Number 23, held on the 5th of December 2022, be confirmed as a true record. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder. I have a mover in Councillor Fox and a seconder in Councillor Gladewright. Councillor Antoli, I know you foreshadowed with me that you wanted to speak about the minutes, so Councillor Antoli.
Thank you very much, Mayor. The minutes are regarding the discussion we had around the landscape conservation zone motion that Councillor Dean put forward. I just need some clarification, if you don't mind, Mayor. My recollection is that Councillor Dean put forward a motion. It was amended by the Deputy Mayor, and as seconder of the motion, I made mention that I was happy to support the amendment because I understood that it would be in addition to correspondence going to the LCZ affected individuals as per Councillor Dean's motion. And on the recording, there was some sort of confirmation from you about that. So I was happy to vote for it as an addition to, not a replacement of. But I was wondering if you could help clarify either my misunderstanding or correct understanding.
Thank you. The motion that was originally moved by Councillor Dean, that was seconded by yourself, had a different set of words, because that was it was talking about communicating with specifically just the LCZ property owners, and then it articulated what the that communication would be in terms of it was wanting a mail out. The alternative motion that had been put forward by Councillor Gladewright replaced the entire motion, and it replaced the notion of just sending out letters to the 1952 people that were affected by LCZ, changed that to having what we believed, and I think Councillor Gladewright outlined, a more effective way of communicating with them through holding the pop-up sessions, of which we intend, and I know you questioned whether there was one or two, and certainly it is our intention to hold two on different days and at different times, even though we didn't have that the plural in there. I'll just confirm that. But what we will be doing is also then, when the rates notices go out in June or early July, there will be a letter that will go out with the rates notice So they will certainly be getting a letter in addition to the pop-up session. So I wouldn't like to think that anyone to think that we're watering down the consultation. We're actually trying to give the additional sessions not now, but in probably February, early February or thereabouts. Then a letter will go, and then the letter will go in with the rates notices, so that will go to everybody. Then we will have, once the actual formal 60-day consultation takes place, there will be more communication then.
All right. Thank you for clarifying, Mayor. You would notice that there were other individuals in the community that was likewise confused as myself, so the clarification for them is important, lest they think we were unintentionally watering down the intent of the motion.
No.
And I do appreciate you giving them that assurance that it's going to be more communication, not less.
Yep.
Thank you. So based on that, I'm happy to go ahead and also support the minutes.
Thank you. Any further discussion on the minutes? Otherwise, I will put the motion to confirm the minutes. It was moved by Councillor Fox and seconded by Councillor Glade-Wright. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried unanimously. Workshops held since the last council meeting. We had a workshop on the 12th of December with Leiden Builders, and then we also discussed the flag policy. Declarations of interest on page 2. Does any councillor have a declaration of interest that they wish to share? Councillor Midgley.
I have one in closed session.
Thank you. Could you tell us the item number that that relates to, please?
Sorry, I have to look it up. Sorry, it's the first one. Item number 21.1.
Thank you. Councillor Glade-Wright.
I have a declaration of interest to declare, but I think it's going to be moved to closed session.
Okay. Could you just give us the item number, please?
15.2.
Thank you. Any further declarations? If not, we'll move on. Transfer of agenda items. Is there any item on the agenda that a councillor would like to transfer from open into closed session or closed into open session? Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. I'd like to move item 15.2 into closed session based on meeting guidelines under the 2015 guidelines from the state government, as the item itself is connected to current legal matters in connection with council and the actual item itself, and I'd like us to be able to discuss it more fully and freely without prejudicing either our or the litigant's case.
Thank you. So that's a motion from Councillor Antoli that agenda item 15.2 be transferred into closed session. Do I have a seconder for that motion? Councillor Dean. I'll put the motion that item 15.2 be moved into closed session, moved by Councillor Antoli, seconded by Councillor Dean. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? The motion is carried unanimously, I think. I didn't hear an against. No. Thank you very much. So that we will make sure that when we come to that, it will move into closed session. We now come to questions without notice from the public. Does any member of the public who's with us this evening wish to ask a question without notice? Oh, I thought that's why you're all here. Can't hear very well? Oh, I'll move it a bit closer. Is that a little bit better? I'll use my big parent voice. My apologies. Thank you. No questions on without notice from the public. We have a number of questions on notice from the public, and I, as my usual infomercial, if you wish to submit a question on notice, you should send it to kc@kingborough.tas.gov.au and it will appear on the next available agenda. We had a number of questions. The first one is in relation to biodiversity offsets from Mr. Biggins, with an officer's response from Ms. Quinn. The second one is in relation to biodiversity offset policy from Mr. Biggins, with an officer's response from Ms. Quinn. The third one is zoning from Ms. Hanson, with an officer's response from Ms. Tyler Moore. The fourth one is on workshops from Ms. O'Keefe, with an officer's response from Mr. Smee. The fifth one, landscape conservation zone from Ms. O'Keefe, with an officer's response from Dr. Fox. Sixth one, staffing from Professor Michael Rowan with an officer's response from Ms. Everingham. Seventh one, public open space contribution policy from AJ Kingston and an officer's response from Mr. Stander and Mr. Breen. And the final one is in relation to a planning scheme amendment from Ms. Landon and an officer's response from Ms. Tyler Moore. Which takes us to page 9, questions without notice from councillors. Does any councillor wish to ask a question without notice? I've got Councillor Gladewright, then Councillor Richardson, then Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. I understand that following the last council meeting held on the 6th of December 2022, that a representative from the LGBTIQA plus community who was present at the meeting was upset by some comments made during the debate of the LGBTIQ plus A plus strategic plan. Would the Mayor like to comment on this?
Thank you, Councillor Gladewright. I thank you for the question. You are correct in saying that there has been some concern expressed directly to me about some comments that were made at the last council meeting held on the 6th of December. That took place during the debate that we had on the LGBTIQA plus strategic plan. So in response to that, I have met with a resident last week to understand these concerns. Tonight, on behalf of Council, I would sincerely like to apologise to members of the LGBTIQA plus community who were offended by some of these remarks during the course of the debate. The strategy that we were debating is a really valuable piece of work, and I hope that it will ensure that as a community and as a council, we can foster a more inclusive, caring and understanding environment for everyone who lives here, who works here and who comes to visit our municipality. So on behalf of council, I would offer my sincere apologies to members of the community for any distress caused, and I do hope that we can move forward with implementing the strategy, but I think really importantly that we can work together now in a more inclusive and positive and caring way. Thank you. Now move to Councillor Richardson.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask about works on Sprowls Road. I've had a couple of emails throughout the week concerning the condition of the road. And the residents are saying that normal maintenance schedule would be okay, but for the last couple of years there's been a succession of council trucks going up the road attending to something on a property further up the road, which has caused additional damage. So further to that, today I've been informed that there has been a grader there today, which is wonderful, but the question is there an opportunity to look at a tar and chip solution for Sprowls Road in Snug?
I think we're going to have to take the question on notice because we don't have Mr. Reeve here this evening. You've chosen probably the one meeting that he's not at, but if we could take that on notice, we'll get a response for you.
No problems.
That's probably saved about half an hour because Mr. Reeve has very lengthy answers. He's probably watching at home right now. Thank you. He does give very comprehensive answers. Yep. Do you have a further question?
Yeah, I do. My second question is in relation to hard rubbish. What is the council's policy or process with hard rubbish?
This is a question that that arises every now and then, particularly from somebody who perhaps has moved into the area where they've come from Clarence, where they are one of the few councils that still have a hard rubbish collection. Look, I can't even remember Kingborough Council having a hard rubbish collection in the time that I've lived here, which has been since 1990, so I don't know if one did take place prior to that. One of the biggest impediments to it is there's a range of issues with hard waste collection these days. One of it, quite honestly, is the cost. It is around $400,000 a year for the Clarence Council to operate their hard waste collection. But over and above that, there are some difficulties with... there are WH&S concerns because effectively things are out on the footpath for about four or so weeks by the time the collections take place right around the municipality, and they are blocking footpaths. You also then have very sharp and dangerous items that, you know, children could play with and so on. So there, it's quite a complicated issue. I know that there is a preference for some people that, you know, when they're used to that, to be able to have a hard waste collection. But at this point, it's not something that we're able to offer. We do have the free days at the green waste obviously, but you can drop things off to the tip shop and things that could be repurposed, which can sometimes be perhaps a better option than just wanting to dispose. But there's certainly not a simple answer to it, and I know that Clarence Council have tried several times to actually halt it, but they met with strong community resistance, so it's certainly a difficult one to come up to a solution for.
Okay, thank you. And one last question, if I may. In the tendering process, when we look at the assessment of those tenders, there's a matrix and some weightings that are posted to those. Have we thought about, or is there an opportunity to look at adding a local ownership weighting to the business, to the tender, so that we're giving some weight to locally owned businesses and giving them a bit of a leg up?
Acting General Manager.
Through you, Mayor, that issue has been discussed previously. It doesn't currently form part of our tendering policy. There is reference to it in our tendering policy. But there's not a specific weighting given. That would need to be considered as part of a review of that policy.
Thank you. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. My question is about road line markings. Since the last council meeting, when I raised some issues about road line markings on Redwood Road and also Auburn, since raising that issue, I've been contacted by a constituent raising the issue of the following roads in Blackmans Bay that also have faded line markings, potentially causing a safety concern: Roslyn, Burwood, Illawarra, Opal, Diamond Drive, Suncoast Drive, Wells Parade. And last time we heard about the responsibility falling to the state government, and essentially we submit roads that need doing to the state government, and then the answer kind of came back that there's always a paucity of resources and funds available for the number of roads that we need marked up. So really my question is actually about advocacy. Have we ever lobbied the state government to more adequately fund line marking on the imperative of road safety, and perhaps advocating for the inclusion of better road safety line markings as an inclusion into the Towards Zero strategy and action plan, which has a focus on road safety efforts over the next decade?
We don't have Mr. Reeve here this evening, so if you don't mind, we'll take that on notice. But it's not something that I can recall in recent years that we have advocated for, but I'm sure Mr. Reeve will be able to fill in some details.
Thank you.
Councillor Midgley, and then Councillor Dean.
Thank you, Mayor. I have a couple of road questions, the hot topic. I'm not sure if other councillors received a letter regarding Auburn Road, but I've been written by a local resident regarding a potentially fatal situation, and they're referring to Auburn Road in Kingston, where cars park on both sides of the street, three-quarters parked from Hutchinson Street side. Cars are parking on the left side of the road and near the crest of the road, as well as before the crest and after the crest. The resident believes it's a traffic hazard, as motorists can't see safely ahead around the crest, and they feel that it's very dangerous and could lead to crash and injuries. It has resulted in motorists driving on the wrong side of the road to avoid parked cars and oncoming traffic. They noted it's school buses and metro buses use this road, which is another concern. There is no room to pass and it's very tight and horrendous. Embarking and disembarking passengers are fraught with unacceptable risk when traffic is so congested. Wondering, could the council investigate how to best solve this potentially dangerous situation?
Thank you for the question. Once again, we'll ask Mr. Reeve to address that on notice, but I do know he is aware of the issue. I've had a discussion with him about Auburn Road. There are a number of issues with Auburn Road, particularly the footpaths and the narrow width of the footpath. Auburn Road is in our forward program for a major upgrade, I think maybe for next year, because certainly it's well overdue, and I know there have been representations from other residents from that area about concerns about where the cars are parking and the difficulties there. So I do know that Mr. Reeve is looking at it, but I'll let him provide you with some details on notice.
Great, thank you very much. The next question is in regards to the infrastructure services report in the appendix of the agenda, page 93, the electric vehicle charging station, which is fantastic. Is that available for public use and how will it work?
So it will be available for public use. It's not fully installed as yet, or it wasn't on Friday when I asked. It is located in our car park, but I don't know, do you have anything else to add? No. No, so it hasn't. It's been a long, slow process because, as you're aware, we ordered this over 2 years ago and the parts didn't come from overseas. So as soon as it is commissioned, if you like, or I don't know, maybe I cut the ribbon for it or something, then we will certainly make available some information to members of the community via our social media and the Chronicle, etc., so they know where it's located and how they can access it.
Thank you. And just thank you for the infrastructure report. It is really great to get the highlight of all the different projects and see the hardworking teams out there doing great stuff. The next one, I ask this question regularly and I had a ponder about that and thought it's actually a low-cost project that so many residents who live in Howden and who travel on the road...
Brightwater?
The Channel Highway Road. Oh. Sorry, Channel Highway. In regards to the Channel Highway Corridor Infrastructure Report, it was to lower the speed limit for a very short time from 90 to 80. And many residents are concerned, and it's all over the local social media pages. It was a small, we think, action, and many people think small action. We've written to the Minister. People are writing letters. I don't see much cost in regards to putting an 80-kilometre sign there. What do we need to do, I guess? And I know that you couldn't answer that, Mayor, but if we are meeting with any of our ministers, and I note that we are having a meeting soon, that would be a very good one to raise, as I know the community are sort of, you know, just hoping that a solution can happen.
Look, I certainly agree. I'm happy to write to the Minister for Infrastructure again about that. I know I've raised it in the past, but certainly, yes, that is the longer-term plan is to have a roundabout there or some other way of being able to enter more effectively into that area, and there are concerns about the site distances and so on. So I'm happy to write a further letter to the Minister for Infrastructure, but when we meet with our local member, Minister Street, in January, we shall also raise it with him.
Great, thank you. And just one last question. In regards to council committees, can all councillors receive the agendas for those committees, and can councillors attend if they wish and perhaps seek advice or request from the chair to attend council committees as an observer?
I'm not clear on that, but the acting general manager.
Through you, Mayor, yes, certainly the protocol would be to seek the permission of the chair, but there's nothing precluding a councillor from attending a committee meeting. Obviously, you couldn't participate in any vote or debate, but attendance is no problem.
And just in relation to being provided with the agenda, can they we just add them into Dropbox for when those agendas are circulated?
Yes, Mayor, that would be the way to go.
Thank you. Any further questions? Oh, Councillor Dean.
Yeah, look, I've just got two questions, but I did want to start by thanking Dr. Fox for her response to 10.5, which clarified from the motion that we did last meeting that clarified that there will be multiple sessions and that we'll be piggybacking on rates notices. That was really good. I think also answered potentially Councillor Antoli's question at the beginning around the minutes. But my first question, I suppose, is just around the support of local charities here in Kingborough that Council provides. obviously Christmas is just around the corner, and I wanted to obviously acknowledge all the amazing work that local charities does, but it got me thinking then, what do we do as a new councillor? I'm interested in what council does in terms of providing whether it's financial or facility or whatever otherwise kind of support for local charities here in Kingborough.
So we throughout the mayoral donations program, we are quite often, I know in the time that I've been mayor, that I've received letters from various charities to request assistance, and certainly we would consider those, making sure they're obviously appropriate. Probably the biggest thing I think we can all do is, as individual councillors, is to assist some of those charities by, you know, buying a toy and putting it under the Kingborough Helping Hands tree, or making a donation of some way, and encouraging others in the community that are able to do the same. But generally speaking, I guess the financial support is through mainly donations, and it might be grants at other times of the year. I know, speaking to Edna Pennicott the other day, they had a very successful fundraising event, their lunch, where they raised around $18,500, and she said no sooner had they raised it that they spent that same amount on food and toys for families that couldn't afford it. So any amount of help is greatly appreciated, and I know that there are quite a few councillors around this table who have been very good in assisting with Helping Hands and with other charities, and certainly I'd continue to encourage that.
Yeah, I spoke to Edna yesterday, and she had noted how the number of children they're supporting in the area has gone from, you know, 30 or 40 to up to 600 now that they're providing toys for, so they do an amazing job. Second question just relates into workshops and follows up question 10.4 from Ms. Mill-O'Keefe. In our workshop policy, it states that we include a summary of workshops that we've held in the previous to the current meeting. And I note that our neighbouring council in Hobart does provide at least a few paragraphs describing what was discussed and general focuses of discussions and that kind of thing. But in our agendas, we only really give like a one-line subject kind of heading of what the topic is. And in today's agenda, the subject line is light and builders and flag policy. And so I'm wondering, given the nature of especially today or last Mondays with light and builders, whether there's whether it's in our interest or the public's interest that we give a little bit more information, and given that that is in our policy to give a bit of a summary. So I guess my question is potentially to you or to the General Manager, whether we should be providing a bit more information, council agendas, so that we don't avoid potentially any kind of issues on that.
Thank you for the question. Look, certainly we are in adherence with the meetings procedures regulations, because they indicate at 8.2 what the agenda should comprise of, and it just says the date and purpose of any council workshop held since the last meeting. But I agree with you that in the interests of transparency and good governance, that we could do a little bit more into, you know, add a couple of sentences so that the community have an understanding of what it is that we're discussing. It may be the case that that's not always possible to go into much detail, depending on what the subject of the workshop is, and whether it was, because on occasions we may workshop something that will be then later held in closed session, so we need to be mindful of those sorts of things. But certainly I'm aware that it varies between councils. I know that whilst Hobart has quite a large paragraph, Glenorchy and Clarence are very much like us. They just have a title, or who, you know, who attended and so on. But certainly that's something I'm happy to have a look at and discuss with council staff and look at in the new year. Are there any further questions? No. If not, I will we will move on. Okay, where are we? Questions on notice from councillors. We're on page 9. There were 5 questions on notice from councillors, one from Councillor Fox in relation to plastic milk bottles with a response from Mr. Reeve, One from Councillor Bain in relation to public transport, Spring Farm and Whitewater Park Estates, with a response from Mr Smee. Three questions from Councillor Midgley. The first in relation to Huntingfield Park and Ride, with a response from Dr Fox. Second one in relation to Youth Action Strategy, also with a response from Dr Fox. And the final one, the development of the LGBTIQA+ Action Plan 2325, with a response also from Dr Fox. We turn now to page 12, petitions still being actioned. There are no petitions currently still being actioned, and at the time the agenda was compiled, there were no petitions that had been received. Which brings us to the first of the officer's reports to council, annual budget mid-year review, with a recommendation on page 16. And I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. I've got a mover in Councillor Gladewright and a seconder in Councillor Cordova. Councillor Gladewright.
Thank you. The purpose of this report is to review the budget forecast after 5 months of actual expenditure and consider the progress in delivering the capital works program and to seek adjustments to individual budget items. I note that inflation is having a significant impact, and another factor that's being experienced this year is the impacts of significant rainfall. So it's prudent that at this stage of the year, Council consider the current situation and make some decisions accordingly, and we've been presented with some adjustments to the program. The recommendation is asking us to endorse a reallocation of approximately $1.2 million, works associated with Gormley Drive and a part deferral of the Blowhole Road reconstruction, and instead using it to complete some other projects which are listed there on page 17. So I think it's a wise decision. I think this is responsible accounting, and I endorse the report.
Thank you, Councillor Gladewright. Any further comments? Councillor Midgley and then Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. Yes, thank you, staff, for the report. It is... gives a very good predicament as to where we are and so many other councils and communities and individuals are really facing and the hard hits that we're getting in regards to our budget. My question is around, I have a question around Gormley Drive. So noting the budget's 130K, and for anyone who goes on that road, which I do many times a week, well, the soccer oval's not quite finished yet, so not as much, but it is... For riding and driving on that road, it is probably one of the worst roads in Kingborough, and I'm not a massive road sealing advocate, but this one. So if I can just get some understanding in regards to then... So it's going to be deferred until an investigation of options is completed. I guess what has been some of the issues that have been found in here, and it will be put forward for consideration in the 2023-24 budget. That doesn't mean it will actually will get completed, but I'm just wanting some more information. But if Mr Reeve isn't here to answer that question, then it makes it a bit difficult, I guess.
He isn't, but I think in the report it alludes to the fact that there are some water drainage issues that are impacting Gormley Drive, and so it would be prudent to fully investigate those and re-scope the design work before just... putting a seal on it and then finding that it's actually not assisting things, because it could, if the water keeps flowing at the rate it is, I think the road surface would deteriorate fairly quickly. But given that this has been slated for some time, I'd feel confident that it would, if put forward, it would get on the capital program. But obviously that's a matter for all of us during the budget deliberations. But I think we appreciate... That is certainly a well-used road and one that is kind of the missing link, if you like, of an unsealed road, fairly central in urban Kingston. So I know that I would certainly like to see that done as well. I know members of Little Athletics and the clubs that utilise all the sporting facilities there are very keen to as well. But I can ask Mr Reeve to provide some further details out of session, if you like.
Thank you. So it looks like we have enough money, or possibly, hopefully have enough money to do more investigative works to rectify this problem. Thanks.
Yeah. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. Just a few questions. The first one is about 4.32 statutory fees and fines. Statutory fees and fines are currently $132,000 under budget, due primarily to planning fees, which are $70,000 under budget, and compliance fees, which are $53,000 under budget. The volume of planning applications has decreased this year in comparison to past years, and areas such as parking and bylaw fees and fines are below previous years. Just seeking some analysis about why the volume of planning applications we think has decreased in comparison to previous years, and also around the parking and bylaw fees and fines, and do we anticipate an uptick again later, or is this the new normal?
Thank you. I'll ask Dr. Fox to answer that. My understanding in relation to the development applications is that part of the contributing factor is that people wanting to build a house are struggling to find people to actually do the work, and therefore are delaying putting off their DAs in. But I'll ask Dr. Fox if she could elaborate.
Sure. So you are correct, Mayor, that that is the case, that some people are finding it difficult to find builders and others in the industry, and so they are delaying their development applications. We are seeing this trend across Greater Hobart, though, and indeed across Tasmania, where development applications had increased exponentially over the last 2 years with COVID stimulus funds coming through the economy. We had massive uptake in development and development applications. This has now steadied off and is just starting to come back down. Now, we're still very much ahead of where we were 3 years ago in terms of development applications. The planning staff are still very much under the pump, but we're finally starting to see that plateauing off and starting to come back down to more reasonable levels, I guess. So while it might seem concerning, it's certainly not coming back to the levels that we saw 3 years ago as yet. And in fact, this is just a stabilisation of the industry.
Thank you. That's helpful context.
I will ask Mr. Basham to address the compliance issues for you. Mr. Basham.
Through you, Mayor. We've had our issues in relation to staffing and otherwise with COVID over this period. But on reflection, I don't have the figures in front of me, the gross workload of the unit is actually still reasonably stable. I guess what we're looking at is that there's a net loss in relation to fees and fines being paid, and also concerning things such as building matters and loop matters, which come with quite significant fines attached to them. They may not just as... like I said, there's a gross workload and there hasn't been a net income yet.
I'd like to think that we're a more compliant community, but...
Of course. Sure.
Law-abiding.
My next question is about the state government contract... Well, OK, so I'm looking at 4.3.4 under other income. It's currently $160,000 under budget due to the loss of the Bruny Island contract with the state government to maintain main roads on the island. This reduction in income will be offset by decreases in expenditure to the amount of around $300,000. So the way I read that is that we're essentially even Steven for the whole deal, that it, you know, it's offset. But my question is really just I'd like a bit more analysis about why that happened and whether it's good for us or bad for us. Will it change in future? Just a bit more background about the Bruny Island contract.
Mr. Breen, who I note was also the winner of the social event, Christmas event in Barefoot Bowls the other night. Congratulations, Mr. Breen.
Thank you, Mayor. look, in regards to the Bruny Island contract, This contract was underway for a number of years. We spent a lot of time working with the State Growth Department trying to get a contract in place and get some certainty about the works that we were doing down there. Unfortunately, in the end, they chose to have they're focusing on a statewide agreement rather than just individual agreements for particular areas. So that caused us to lose the contract. So basically it's about $500,000 in income a year that we lose. That's been offset somewhat by expenditure, about $50,000 in regards to staff. We had one employee that left and we didn't replace that employee until the contract was finalised, and so therefore that didn't occur. The other $250,000 will be a reduction in contract costs. I mean, a lot of the work that we did down there was contracted out. So the net result for council is actually a $200,000 loss of income as a net result of this loss of contract. So it has had a reasonable sort of impact on council's finances.
Okay, thank you. That's a bit more dire than I thought. My next question is about landslips, and basically, as we heard from the Deputy Mayor, with significant rainfall patterns, a number of landslips have occurred that are too large to be managed via Council's maintenance accounts. These sites have been made safe, that's a critical point, and are currently being investigated for the most appropriate rectification options. It's expected that $100,000 will be needed to divert to these works this financial year. My question around this is, obviously, there's significant rainfall that's happened now, but we also anticipate more frequent and severe weather events in general. Does this mean that these fixes of these landslip areas, will these be permanent fixes, or is this just rectification momentarily, but that we expect that these are still vulnerable areas into the future?
Really wish we had Mr. Reeve here this evening, but we might have to take that on notice.
That's okay.
Unfortunately.
No worries. And my final question, which I guess will also be on notice, is just about the dot point above the Lawless Road extension and car parking. Really, basically it says here that it's recommended that Van Moray Road resheeting from Petted Road towards the end is brought forward as a project, estimated cost of $250,000. This is an area that I've received much correspondence about, and so I'm really pleased to see this moving forward, and I was interested in getting a bit more context, but I'm happy to take that offline. But just to conclude my contribution, Mayor, I think that the main 2 points here is that inflation is this uncertainty that's now affecting us in a big way, land tax, fuel, IT contracts and building materials, and of course the rain events that have cost us. I guess it behoves us all to take into account the significant impact that climate change is actually already having. I'm not at all suggesting that, you know, 3 La Niñas in a row is somehow climate change related. I'm just saying we need an overall awareness, separating, of course, you know, weather from climate. We just need awareness. This of course, impacts our budget in significant ways, and that's why taking meaningful steps for climate action here in Kingborough is so useful, which is why I'll continue to advocate for a waste reduction and reducing waste to landfill as our main mechanism to get to net zero by 2030. Once again, thank you to the author and the authoriser, and I think I'll end on quoting 7.1 about risk. There are no particular risks associated with this report. Projects that have been suggested for deferral have been done to allow additional investigation, design and negotiation to be undertaken, and additional projects have been put forward to take advantage of savings made and to manage the half-yearly capital budget deficit. So at the end of this snapshot, we're halfway through, halfway mark of the year, and I'm feeling quite comfortable with how things are going. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Councillor Richardson, I have next.
Yeah, thank you. My question's also about Lawless Road. So it says that it's now going to require planning approval and it's likely to be delayed. So my question is, planning approval from whom? And is it likely delayed? Is it definitely delayed? Because if it's not delayed, and then that funding and that project is taken off the table and the funding put elsewhere, does that put us behind on that project, or where does that leave us?
The Acting General Manager said, I'll give it a go.
Through you, Mayor. So obviously the planning approval comes from our planning department. Council projects are subject to exactly the same provisions of everyone else with respect to the requirement for development applications. I'm guessing that the reference to being delayed, obviously it will take time to obtain a planning permit, which then puts the works potentially back into autumn and winter, which would be an undesirable time to do that work. But I would need to confer with Mr. Reeve to obtain further information.
We'll take that part of it on notice. Thank you. Councillor Richardson. Councillor Dean.
Yeah, thank you. My question relates to 4.33 under user fees. Part of this really relates to the increased revenue, I suppose, that comes from increasing court hire at the sports centre. And I know that basketball and pickleball have had rapid growth in the last year or so. So I guess my first question is if we could just get a general update from Council in terms of what we're doing to cater for the increased demand of court-based sports, maybe just briefly over the medium term. And secondly, what is the process that we have for reviewing and setting of fees there at the Sports Centre?
Before I go to the Acting General Manager, the basketball predominantly relates the additional revenue to the fact that our wonderful Tasmanian Jack Jumpers have been training there for, this is the second year now, and I think that was, $40,000 per annum. So that was obviously unbudgeted for, but I'll ask the Acting General Manager to address the rest of your question.
Thank you, Mayor. You are correct. The uptake in income at the Sports Centre is primarily due to having the Jack Jumpers there. The Jack Jumpers are there in the morning, and that hasn't impacted on our regular users. The demand for court space is largely of an evening, although pickleball do occupy space on our courts in the afternoon. So we are now at a point where there is significant competition for court space, particularly on the most popular hours, which tend to be between 6 and 8. The process for reviewing the fees that are set, the fees set at the Sports Centre are set by Council as part of the annual budget process. So Sports Centre fees are included within our fees and charges, and they get reviewed as part of that budget process.
If I can just add to that, just in relation to capacity, during the last federal election, the Council had put forward as one of our high priorities a proposal to all major parties for a much-needed extension to the Kingborough Sports Centre because we had received some state government funding to the tune of $100,000 to look at, to do a report into the netball facilities there. As you'll be aware, most of the netball courts are outside. Some of them are in need of repair. And so as part of the overall strategic plan for the Kingborough Sports Centre precinct, there have been some plans prepared that would increase the number of indoor courts up to, from the 4 that we have at the moment, double it up to 8. But the cost of the project is such that that is not something that Council can fund solely on our own. We would need state and federal contributions towards it. Unfortunately, we were not successful in getting commitments from any of the politicians in relation to this. They all saw the merits of it, but we are in a situation now where we really can't grow. Pickleball, for example, as you've mentioned, you know, they're seeking additional time. They have about 100 people who play pickleball. They say they could cater for far more, but we can't give them the space to do so. We've had issues in the past where volleyball weren't able to play here for some time. So it is very competitive, and I think it's probably, unfortunately, a result of not being in a marginal seat. There was a significant funding commitment to Devonport in the last federal election of $20 million for a sports centre upgrade up there. In a municipality, or sorry, city in their case, which is about half the population of Kingborough. So I find that very frustrating, but it's certainly something that we will continue to push with both levels of government to see if we can't get an increase in the facilities there for the community to use. Are there any further comments on the annual budget mid-year review? Councillor Gladewright, did you want to sum up? No. I will put the motion then. It's moved by Councillor Gladewright, seconded by Councillor Cordova. It's as printed on the screen. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? The motion is carried unanimously. The next item on page 19, which is the AGM notice of motion, personal bushfire shelters, has been moved into closed session. So we now go to page 25. Annual General Meeting Notice of Motion Continuous Improvement Policy. I just note for the record that Councillor Street has joined to the meeting. He did messaged me to indicate he'd been held up at his other workplace. So welcome, Councillor Street, to the meeting at 6:20 p.m. So I'm looking for a mover and a seconder for the continuous improvement policy motion with a recommendation on page 28. Councillor, moved by Councillor Gladewright, seconded Councillor Cordova. Councillor Gladewright.
Thank you, Mayor. This report responds to a notice of motion that was moved and carried at Council's annual general meeting on the 3rd of December that Council consider adoption of a continuous improvement policy. This policy can produce more effective governance infrastructure for councillors, improve service delivery for the community and has potential to aid staff retention. I note that Council has policies, procedures, strategies and plans that challenge Council's operations to be effective and efficient and to be customer-centric, and we also have continuous improvement activities that are further supported by its commitment to customer experience, employee satisfaction, service reviews, consultation and compliant management. But as the report says at 4.3, nevertheless, a submission of the motion, it is recognised that while Council does independently address principles of continuous improvement and operates within a continuous improvement framework, its methods are not encapsulated in a singular policy. So it is proposed that the continuous improvement policy be drafted for endorsement by Council. I think it's a really wonderful idea. I thank the Kingborough Ratepayers Association for bringing this to us, and I look forward to hearing what other councillors have to say about it.
Thank you, Councillor Gladewright. Further speakers? Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. I have had a few discussions with the Kingborough Ratepayers Association on this, and they have actually approached me to put this up as a motion. If this had failed at the AGM, but I was actually happy to be there to see that it actually was very popular, and I do support it. And the importance of a continuous improvement policy is that it's designed to catch us making mistakes and stopping us from repeating those mistakes. For example, Councillor Dean's excellent comment before about us needing to stick to our workshop policy and clarify a little bit more than we have been on the way we publish that in the minutes. So a CIP would really sort of hopefully capture that so that people like Councillor Dean can catch us doing something else, I suppose, as he's want to do, because he's obviously got good brains and a lot of time on his hands to keep us to account, and I do commend that, actually. So thank you. I do commend this, and I support the... And I want to thank the KRAI for pushing this. Second year, fortunate, because last year didn't unfortunately get up, and this year it's hopefully off and ready.
Thank you, Councillor Antoli. If there are no further speakers, I'll just say a few words in relation to it. Sorry, then I'll go to you, Councillor Fox. Look, I strongly support this, and I know it's something that the Kingborough Ratepayers Association have been very passionate about for some time, and as Councillor Antoli mentioned, they did try to have this passed at last year's AGM, and it failed, but I'm glad that they have come back to this year's. We should always strive for continuous improvement. There is absolutely no doubt about it. And I feel that that is something that we do, but I don't think we articulate very well at the moment that we do that. So I think that this would be of benefit to Council and ultimately then to our community. I think that... one of the things that we always need to be mindful of is the processes that we use, and just because something used to be done in a particular way doesn't mean it's the best way to do it. And if we have a framework of a continuous improvement policy, then certainly we would be looking at those sorts of things and saying, well, you know, are we actually using the most effective way to do what we do at all levels? Is there a way that we can improve it? The notion of continuous improvement has certainly been referred to in the state government's future local government review. And in fact, if I can quote from that, they've already said there is significant room for improvement in the overall standard of local governance in Tasmania. So I think it's very timely that we would be looking at implementing this. I did try to find out which other councils in the state currently have a continuous improvement policy. I'm not sure. I haven't been able to identify yet which ones do. But I'd like to think that it would be good if there were others that already did have policies in place. But I would like to think that as we have in other areas, such as having the caretaker policy, that Kingborough Council can lead the way in relation to this. Certainly, continuous improvement is used in state and federal governments. There is absolutely no reason why we can't be adapting that into local government, and in fact, we should. The notion of continuous improvement is certainly not a new one. It is something that has been around, I understand, since about World War II, where it can be traced back to Japanese manufacturing after World War II. And the model became quite widely used in the 1980s and then and since then. So I do find it curious that perhaps the notion hasn't found its way to local government, given it's been in businesses and within the state and federal governments for so long. So I certainly look forward to this. I would like to see that as part of drafting the policy, that we build into it, we consider where a continuous improvement policy would sit along with the general manager's KPIs in future. I think that would be an important tool to have incorporated within any general manager's contract, that there be some reporting back on the performance against the policy, and I'd also like to see that once we've drafted a policy that we actually do have some community consultation and also a councillor workshop, because I think it would be really interesting. I think there would be many community organisations, not just the Kingborough Ratepayers Association, who I think would probably value the opportunity to have input into this policy, I think it would be valuable for us to also have a workshop to discuss it. So that's my contribution. I had Councillor Fox next.
Thank you, Mayor. Very well put. I just had a little question on page 28, a joint consultative committee. I'm just wondering who that is and if I could have it explained. On the 7.1, last three words.
That is very interesting. I don't believe we have a joint consultative committee, do we? Acting General Manager, anybody? Mr. Basham.
Through you, Mayor. Thank you, Councillor. Yeah, we do have a joint consultative committee, the JCC. It's established under the EBA, and it's a committee which matters at... may affect staff, policies or otherwise go to the committee and they get tested at the committee.
Thank you.
Could I ask who's on it, or is that going into too much detail?
Okay. We can take that on notice. Thank Mr. you. Basham is not able to provide that information at the moment. Councillor Dean.
Yeah, look, I'm not going to echo or repeat your comments there, Mayor, because it's a brilliant motion and I'm really glad that it got up. But I would just say one thing. I didn't spend my 20s attending AGMs or even watching them online, but I did watch this one online. And the process in itself, and there's another really good example later on at 15.7 about the Multicultural Advisory Group where so people from the public can come, who knew? I didn't, can come and pass a brilliant motion and then it gets endorsed by council and we actually, members of the public, are creating really positive change. So I just wanted to actually say the process in itself, it's quite heartening and, yeah, good work.
Thank you, Councillor Dean. Are there any further comments? Councillor Gladewright, would you like to sum up? No? I'll put the motion then as printed in the agenda. It's moved by Councillor Gladewright and seconded by Councillor Cordova. All those in favour? Against?
The motion is carried unanimously. We turn now to page 29, Annual General Meeting Notice of Motion, Biodiversity Offset Funds, with a recommendation on page 33. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. Moved, Councillor Midgley. Seconded, Councillor Fox. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you to the mover of the motion for putting this forward, and thank you, staff, for the comprehensive detail that's provided in this motion. After reading this one and the one that's following, that there's similarity in them. I note would take a lot of time and perhaps making sure that all the information is correct. So I'm really just going to read through some of the things that I saw were a highlight as part of the staff's response. 9.1, the Kingborough Environmental Fund has been a highly successful mechanism for securing biodiversity offsets on behalf of people carrying out development that results in biodiversity loss. And the outcomes of the Kingborough Environmental Fund to date have exceeded offset targets to include the protection of 6 covenants, which are located at Lower Snug, Oyster Cove and North Bruny, and will see over 500 hectares of priority value areas protected. And there is more information about all the different areas across Kingborough that the Kingborough Environmental Fund has done to date. There's a note that based on the evidence provided in this report, there are no grounds for ceasing the work of the Kingborough Environmental Fund or directing payments to an independent not-for-profit trust fund. And a central fund such as that is used by the Kingborough Environmental Fund allows for larger scale projects to be delivered due to a bigger pool of funds available, a coordinated approach for broad species objectives to be achieved. Just writing down my things. And so under then the risk of the environment and the overall risk, so if the administration of the Kingborough Environmental Fund was transferred to an external organisation, the environmental outcomes of the fund would be reduced as the cost of delivering the offsets would be higher, and ceasing the operation of the Kingborough Environmental Fund with no justification is likely to pose a reputational risk for council, and the fund is a widely recognised as a leading program in local government in Tasmania, and no evidence has been produced to suggest that there are any issues with its operation. There is a note there stating that council's audit panel could consider conducting an audit of the Kingborough Environmental Fund next year as part of their forward program, and the budget estimate of this is between $10,000 to $15,000 to conduct the audit. So I am fully supportive that the Kingborough Environmental Fund continues to operate in its current format, and noting the motion that is carried.
Thank you, Councillor Midgley. Further contributions, Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. Those who follow this council and its meetings would be well aware that I've been vocal about the Environmental Fund and the offsets, and in the spirit of making sure that we protect our environment and to align with our strategic plan, I do support this motion, and the reason is that I actually think, firstly, I want to thank the mover of it, because I think it's important that we lend to this program the kind of scrutiny that is important in order to achieve, as it says in the report, something that is transparent, strategic and ecologically robust. So that's something, I guess, that I've been talking about a lot when it comes to this fund, is making sure, for example, that offsets are indeed, as the purpose of them is to be a last resort, that in the hierarchy there's many things that come before an offset is used. And when an offset is used, that it's actually, rather than it being a cost of doing business for a developer, it's actually a disincentive to remove things of natural value. And so I've had my issues with the way in which we go about it, because I wanted to make sure, and I continue to want to make sure, that our targets are ambitious, that they're not easy to meet, that we're actually striving for excellence and we're striving to be the best, not just in Tasmania but in Australia, when it comes to protecting our native wildlife, our flora and our fauna. What goes wrong here with the original motion, which is why I endorse the council officer's recommendation to continue operating the fund, is that, as it says in 9.3, a recent review of the biodiversity offset policy included an assessment of offset models used within Australia and internationally. So we've looked at other jurisdictions, we've tried to see what works and what doesn't, and here's the quote, "It was deemed that an open market model, whilst having many benefits, would not be effective at a municipal scale." So that's essentially saying that in the scale that Kingborough is operating at, this would not be this proposal would not be effective. Most importantly, I think, is that under 4.12, to address question C, the Kingborough Environmental Fund is currently undergoing a review as it has reached the end of its initial four-year program. This review will involve input from the steering committee. The implementation plan will be updated and brought to the council to be endorsed. An external audit has not been planned. However, this could be included in the review. I want to make sure that we're protecting Kingborough's natural assets. I think we're very lucky to live in a municipality that has so many incredible natural and cultural assets, and we need to make sure that we keep it not just for 5 years or for 10, but in perpetuity. We need to make sure that we keep those environmental values so that my great-great-great-grandchildren can enjoy them as previous generations have. So I wanted to strengthen the fund. I wanted to make sure that developers don't use the offsets as just a cost of doing business, that they pay $500 per very high conservation value tree to knock it over. This proposal, however, to cease the operation of the fund and move it into an open market model, as the report clearly outlines, would be very significantly costly and would also not be effective on a municipal scale. So for that reason, I'm pleased to support the motion. But I do welcome the interest in the fund and the interest in biodiversity offsets in general, because it's together, putting our heads together and thinking of the best way to do these things, that we will reach best practice in time. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Next, I've got Councillor Antoli.
Thank you. May I ask some questions about this, please?
Absolutely.
So I am no great expert on this. I do note that I have some pretty strong roots in the more rural part of our Kingborough community, and I noticed that the Biodiversity Offset Fund seems to be quite popular with everyone except those affected by it. So I noticed that it adds a lot of cost to a person setting up a new house, and I believe the move of this motion mentions something about $40,000 being quite a common cost to the average development. I don't know how true that is. So could Dr. Fox explain to me and those listening a little bit more quickly about how this works, and how it, or whoever, through you, Mayor, how it actually operates, and where does the money go? Because that's what people seem to be really concerned about. They look at it as, their words, not mine, a tax.
Ms. Quinn would be the best person to answer that.
Through you, Mayor. Thank you for your question. There are multiple parts to that. So some of them I will answer, and I think some of them will be answered better by my colleague, the things about the offset. So I think there's two things just to be clear about, and it is confusing when we're talking about biodiversity offsets to be able to answer your questions. So biodiversity offsets relate to the policy that council has where we offset where there's unavoidable impacts on native vegetation primarily through the planning scheme. The Kingborough Environmental Fund is the fund that we set up to hold the financial offset. So obviously offsets can be on the same site as the impact, they can be at a different site of the impact with similar values, or they can be financial. So that financial proportion is then held in the Kingborough Environmental Fund by council in the council budget, audited, so it's called the Tree Preservation Fund. If you see that in any of our financial reports, that's where all the financial offsets are held, and they're expended through the Kingborough Environmental Fund, which has the governance model that's explained in the report.
Thank you. Minister Nexter.
Just to expand on that in terms of how it might relate to an individual's development. So not all developments require offsets. Offsets are triggered under the planning scheme where there's an impact on what's called a moderate or a high priority biodiversity value, and those values are within a biodiversity protection area. So it can be in any zone that those values occur, but for a lot of the financial offsets, they're often derived from the more urban type zones where the impacts can be small and there's really no opportunity for on-site offsets because the values are basically being lost and replaced with the development. In the rural landscape, the offset outcome can be negotiated, and so as part of an application, a natural values assessment is required where there is an impact on priority biodiversity values and to determine what that impact is. And as part of that assessment, which is commissioned by the applicant, the offset requirements of the scheme need to be addressed,
and they often propose whether or not it is on-site or financial, and the permits are conditioned accordingly. So in many of the rural contexts, that's where there is the opportunity for an on-site offset, but in some instances, if the impact is really small, so we're talking individual trees or a very small area, it can be difficult to get a meaningful sized offset on site, even if it's available. We may negotiate with them for what would work as a practical on-site offset instead of financial if they're not in a position to meet the financial obligations, but it's not an automatic expectation or requirement that it goes to financial. In many instances, it is an on-site offset. The rates for that financial offset are what is outlined in the policy, and the original rate that the policy started with in 2010 was $10,000 per hectare. That was actually established not by council but by the Forest Practices Authority, and when council became the sole regulator for this clearance, we adopted that same rate, and it went up in the 2016 policy to factor in the administration of the fund, which was to $12,000 a hectare, and then it's had a CPI increase in the last policy, taking it to I think just over 13.5. It's a slightly odd figure now, but that hasn't been implemented yet. The new figure hasn't been implemented yet. That's waiting on the incorporation of the revised policy into the planning scheme. I hope that answers your question. I'm happy to provide.
It answers. Thank you. It answers some questions, if I may, Mayor. If I may continue. Are we under some obligation with a regulation to have a biodiversity offset policy, or is this something that we chose to do?
It's something that Kingborough Council chose to do back in about 2010. And we're one of the few councils in Tasmania that actually has one.
Yes, I understand that. And can you refresh? I wasn't obviously on council in those days. What sort of community consultation did it go through?
I wasn't here then either, but Ms Quinn might recall, or Ms Denexter.
I believe Ms Quinn might have been on maternity leave. Through you, Mayor. The policy, when it was introduced in 2010, was formalising what was already occurring. So we were taking what was being implemented by Forest Practices and Council together, and we formalised that and put it in a policy, so it didn't go through any formal consultation.
Right. I'm very concerned that it didn't go through formal consultation, and that's probably part of the reason why it's so profoundly unpopular with the people that are affected by it. I'm not too sure why we would go into a revenue-generating policy or a community-wide policy that did not go through community consultation. Is there anyone that can explain to me why we would do that? We seem to be big on consultation with other matters.
Acting General Manager.
Through you, Mayor, I think the answer from Ms. Denexter was that it was a practice that we were currently doing, and then simply formalised as part of a policy. Bearing in mind it was 13 years ago now, and our community engagement practices are significantly advanced since then.
And what? How do we go with a policy that there is concern that it's unpopular and it didn't undergo community consultation at its birth? How can it be reviewed? What are the mechanisms for it to be reviewed as to whether or not it's effective and achieving its goals?
Who wants to answer this one? Ms. Quinn?
Through you, Mayor. I think to consider that, we'd need to actually have some evidence that the policy is unpopular. So I've been at council for 13 years now, and as has Mr. Nexter, we've been working with the community, with developers, with ecological consultants who implement the policy. We talk to them weekly, and of course, with any policy, you know, there's discussion about it. I don't believe it's unpopular. If it is, then we could explore that. But I think for council to invest in that, you'd want to have some evidence that it is actually unpopular by majority. So council are very aware of this policy. It's been brought to council many times. They've had many opportunities to ask questions about it. So I guess the consultation, it's not zero consultation. It's consultation through being discussed at council. And, of course, the councillors, you know, you're there to represent the community.
Yes. It's nice that implementers of the policy find it popular. That would make sense, but I don't believe those subjected to the policy would find it popular. Tax collectors love exacting taxes, taxpayers don't enjoy it. There's the sort of analogy I'm thinking, but I would love to just explore what the mechanism would be to get a review of it. I understand it's quite a lucrative
Order,
money.
I'm just wondering if this is relevant to the motion that's before us.
Well, you could argue it is, because we're about to vote on whether or not this policy goes, this motion goes ahead, and it's connected to the fact that it appears
sorry,
to
I need
not
to rule,
have...
Sorry, I need to rule on the point of order. Look, I do think Councillor Antoli is talking about matters relating to the notice of motion, so I will allow him to continue. But I can actually answer your question in
yes,
what is the mechanism. The mechanism would be to bring a notice of motion for Council to consider. Could I also just suggest that, because those of us who have been on Council for more than just the current term have had significant workshops and briefings in relation to how the Biodiversity Offset Policy and the Kingborough Environmental Fund operate. It is quite complex. I think it would be worthwhile if we do provide an opportunity for perhaps a session for the new councillors to get their head around it as a way of asking questions and so on. And then, you know, of course, at any time it is your right to bring a notice of motion on whatever topic you would choose.
Thank you, Mayor. That answers my questions for now. I appreciate that.
Thank you. Further speakers? No. Councillor Midgley, would you like to sum up?
I would, thank you. Thank you for the speakers, and thanks staff for clarifying some of the questions from Councillor Antoli. I think for me it really highlights your vast knowledge in this area. I wasn't here 13 years ago. Also, but noting that when we have done local surveys about what people love about living in Kingborough or even for the Main Street upgrade, what people did value were trees and the environment that is Kingborough. It's why people move here. They want to see it protected. People, you know, want to see the skylines protected and things like that all the time, they are telling me, and that's what highlights in different local surveys that come about. Like Councillor Cordova, I agree these discussions are important. We have diversity on Council. It is part of that continuous quality improvement that was highlighted before, but also I would set the funds higher than they currently are. Our environmental values are important, and I know that sometimes when I say this there's some eye rolls, but we're in a climate and biodiversity emergency exclamation mark.
Thank you, Councillor Midgley. I wasn't choking on what you just said. I just took a gulp of water just at the wrong time. I thought you were going to keep going. That's closed the debate. The motion is as printed in the agenda and on the screen. It's moved by Councillor Midgley, seconded by Councillor Fox. All those in favour? Against? The motion is carried unanimously. We turn now to item 15.5. AGM Notice of Motion Biodiversity Offset Credit with a recommendation on page 37, and I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. Moved Councillor Cordova, seconded Councillor Midgley. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. I think we've litigated a lot of the points of this. I mean, this is a similar topic, but to read the 4.4, in summary, there are existing exemptions for biodiversity offsets, including where necessary for the protection of an existing dwelling in accordance with an endorsed bushfire hazard management plan or strategic hazard reduction as part of the Tasmanian Fire Service Reduction Program or equivalent. These exemptions sit within the planning scheme and any other applicable regulations. Council does not have the discretion to introduce additional exemptions contrary to the planning scheme or other regulations, and I guess then in summary, taking the report as read, obviously, but in the event that Council did introduce an environmental accounting system, there would be significant cost in establishing and maintaining this system. I had a question on that, if I might, so I'm looking at 5.2. How much would that cost be, and have we done a feasibility study or had even considered the idea of an environmental accounting system, because if it's a good idea, we should definitely look into it. So my first question is about 5.2. Tell us about environmental accounting systems and if we should get one.
Ms. Dinexter?
Through you, Mayor. No, we don't have costings for what that would cost to establish an environmental accounting system, and we'd have to take it on notice in terms of what that would involve. I know there's been some discussions internally, but nothing detailed.
Thank you. Through you, Mayor. This is one of the reasons why I do applaud anyone who brings a motion to an annual general meeting of the council, is because it does make us look at things with fresh eyes, and that was certainly something that piqued my interest, is thinking, I know it's put in 5.2 in the context of here's the reason why we shouldn't do it, is because it would be expensive. I actually take the view that it might be expensive, but it also might be a really good idea if it results in more transparent, strategic and robust ecological outcomes, which is exactly what I want to see this council engaging in. The conclusion, as I said, I don't want to relitigate the entire debate that we just had, but in conclusion, there are existing exemptions from biodiversity offsets when it comes to bushfire hazard management. While reasonable bushfire mitigation is supported and a shared responsibility, there's no system for assigning or introducing biodiversity credits, and bushfire mitigation is not directly related to biodiversity benefits. So for those reasons, I'm pleased to support the motion. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Any further speakers? Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. I will not be supporting this motion. I haven't been persuaded by the valuable information provided. I do believe that homeowners and ratepayers that contribute to bushfire mitigation need to be rewarded, and they need to be incentivated, and I do believe a credit is an excellent way to achieve that. Given it's our policy, we can tweak it the way we want within the planning scheme, and I don't understand how we can't do that, unless someone could clarify for me, please, why we can't put credits in there. Could someone help me with that?
Ms. Dinexter?
The process of credits is, and the whole environmental accounting system is separate to biodiversity offsets, so they don't necessarily sit within that accounting system in that same way. While we could amend the policy to not apply offsets in certain circumstances, that would then need to be amended in the planning scheme as well. At the moment, those exemptions sit within either state mandatory or regional mandatory parts of the scheme, not within things that council has certainly has drafted or put forward to the planning commission.
Forgive me, I'm not entirely sure whether or not some form of incentive can be actually added as an amendment to the policy to reward a homeowner for bushfire mitigation.
Ms. Dinexter.
Through you, Mayor. The biodiversity offset policy is about mitigating impacts on biodiversity. That's
yes.
Its purpose. Its purpose isn't to incentivise landowners to implement their bushfire mitigation measures. The measures that the offset policy through the scheme applies to are the measures that are necessary through building regulations for new development. So when somebody proposes a new development, be that a house, be it a hazardous use or a vulnerable use, they have requirements for bushfire hazard management. I'm not sure, you know, in terms of incentivising those, they're regulatory requirements under the building regulations. What the planning scheme does is it acknowledges that there may be an impact on biodiversity, and where there is an impact on biodiversity, the provisions of the scheme apply except where exempt, and those exemptions are established under state and regional mandatory provisions in the scheme as it currently stands.
So would a homeowner who is clearing some land for the purpose of bushfire mitigation, would they be required to make a payment for through the biodiversity offset policy?
Not for an existing dwelling. So if that dwelling is lawful.
Yeah, but for a new one maybe.
But for a new dwelling. And the measures that they need to implement for a new dwelling are the measures necessary to protect the new dwelling. Those measures aren't measures to protect other dwellings. Those measures are very specifically about protecting the asset that they've got an approval to build.
And is there a mechanism to recognise that their little bit of mitigation affects and has a knock-on effect on the community they live in and those around them?
Through the offset policy.
Through their... It can be recognised that their mitigation that they're doing on their block of land has a knock-on effect to hopefully reduce the risk of bushfire to those around them. That then becomes a community effect.
I mean, possibly, but not necessarily through then absolving them of the impact on the biodiversity values. That impact still occurs.
So one could argue that their bushfire mitigation could reduce the impact on the surrounding environment and vegetation if it's effective enough, surely.
The bushfire mitigation is directed at protecting the asset. It's not directed at protecting the bushland around it, and it's not directed at protecting neighbouring assets. It's directed at protecting the asset that they're applying for approval to build.
So from my point of view, I see almost unless I'm mistaken and don't see something here, I almost see the biodiversity offset as in opposition to incentivising people to mitigate bushfire from a cost point of view. Have I missed something?
Well, the bushfire mitigation measures are a requirement of the building regulations. What the planning scheme and the biodiversity offset policy are doing is trying to get people to build that in the least impact place possible and look for sites where they will avoid the need for offsets in the first instance. And the offsets are a last resort. And there are some sites where offsets become necessary if that's a place that people choose to build their dwelling.
Okay, thanks for answering my questions.
Thank you, Councillor Antoli. Next, Councillor Street.
Thank you, Mayor. I just have a question around this, and this has been through Council on a number of occasions for different reasons while I have been a councillor. And one of the queries that Councillor Antoli brought up is one that's always been front of mind for me, and that is this question of a new dwelling and the offsets attached to it and the ability to build that dwelling under the planning scheme but for the fact that we require biodiversity offsets. And so I suppose my question is whether there's ever been any consideration given to single dwelling DAs that might require a biodiversity offset and potentially exempting those that particular class of development application from the requirements of the policy. So that, for example's sake, if there was a single dwelling development application for a site that would otherwise require a biodiversity offset, there's no other possible location for that property, whether we would consider exempting that single dwelling application from the policy.
Through you, Mayor.
Ms. Dennexter.
My understanding is that the planning scheme itself determines when those offsets are required and for what development types. So there are currently rules within the planning scheme that provide special circumstances for that exact scenario, so basically that allow clearing to occur on titles for single dwellings. That is a way of getting to the point where an offset is an acceptable outcome regardless of the impact.
So I suppose my...
So that's the concession that sits in the scheme, and that's the challenge that we have, is that sits within the scheme, and my understanding is that changing the policy isn't going to change the scheme requirements for single dwellings requiring offsets. That exemption would need to, or qualification would need to, sit within the scheme as a development type that isn't requiring the offset rather than in the policy.
Councillor Street, if you say anything else, could you move the microphone a bit closer?
Oh, because sure. I could probably take the mask off while I'm talking.
Sorry.
That'd help.
I've just been alerted by our comms team that it was not very clear to hear you.
Okay, so what you're saying is the exemption that gets you to the point of the offset is within the planning scheme, but the requirement to pay for the biodiversity offset is part of the policy. So there's no mechanism to exclude that single dwelling application from the operation of the policy for the purposes of payment of an offset.
Ms. Dennexter.
Through you, Mayor. The policy sets the rate, the planning scheme creates the requirement.
Okay, I understand. So in order to do what I'm talking about, we would effectively need to do a planning scheme amendment.
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you, Councillor Street. Any further contributions? Councillor Gladright.
Sorry, I thought I was really clear about the biodiversity offset policy, but now I'm a little bit confused. My understanding was if you're going to build a new dwelling and there was you got your BOW and your bushfire attack level says part of your bushfire plan or whatever, you have to clear so much land around your new dwelling, and any of that clearing won't be affected by the biodiversity offset. Is that not correct?
Ms. Dennexter.
Three, Mayor. No, that is not correct.
Okay, further comments? Otherwise, I'll ask Councillor Cordova if you'd like to sum up.
Thank you, Mayor. Very interesting debate. The policy sets the rate, the planning scheme sets the requirement, so ultimately we would need a planning scheme amendment if we were to pursue this line as proposed. And as the motion suggests, we shouldn't, and that's why I moved the motion. Here's the thing. When someone proposes a new development, they have requirements for bushfire hazard management. They have that requirement. There's bushfire regulations. They have regulatory requirements. So whether we should have an incentive, I mean, should we have an incentive for meeting your statutory obligations? Well, that's a matter for debate. I mean, I don't break the law because I have a statutory requirement not to break the law. Should I get rewarded for continuing not to break the law? It would be nice, but it's also... I mean, I think we really need to separate here in this whole discussion the fact that the reason we've got a biodiversity offset policy is firstly to protect biodiversity, but secondly to offset against those losses. It really has very little to do with bushfire mitigation. Those things are often conflated, and I can see exactly why, because there's, you know, anyone can see exactly why. But I think in this case, the reality is unless we want to pursue a planning scheme amendment, I don't think we do. If it were the case that we could just pass a motion here at Council that would change the planning scheme, well, I would have done that a long time ago for a lot of things. I'd get passive solar design in the planning scheme, I'd get solar access, universal access, I'd get separated bike lanes, I'd get climate change resilience, health and wellbeing.
Councillor Cordova.
All that would be enshrined.
Councillor Cordova.
But fundamentally.
You're summing up right now, and what's happening is you've blatantly breach the meeting procedures regulations by introducing new material that isn't even relevant to this current debate. So could we just get back on track to the summary, please?
Forgive me, ma'am. My summary is this. Fundamentally, our biodiversity protection policies are about protecting and offsetting biodiversity losses and protecting biodiversity. If we want to incentivise bushfire mitigation, then we should have an evidence-based approach to that and a separate notice of motion that deals specifically with bushfire mitigation. It should not be conflated with our biodiversity offset policy. We should strengthen our biodiversity offsets. We should also consider ways to help people get prepared for natural disaster. We can do both of those things. They're not mutually exclusive, and I look forward to working with everyone around this table and in the community to achieve those things. This proposal was not the right proposal in order to achieve those two separate but equally important things. And therefore I'm pleased to have moved the motion. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. I'm going to put the motion. Before I do, I just note that Councillor Richardson left the room at 6:59pm and returned at 7:01pm. So I'm going to put the motion now, moved by Councillor Cordova, seconded by Councillor Midgley. All those in favour? Against? Okay, we're going to, if a show of hands is required, please. All those in favour, please raise your hands. That is Councillors Fox, Cordova, Dean, Midgley, Richardson, Street, Gladright and Reet, and those against, Councillor Antoli. The motion is carried. We turn now to page 39, Annual General Meeting Notice of Motion, Kingston Park, with a recommendation on page 41. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. Mover and Councillor Cordova. Oh, sorry.
I can do it.
I don't know who was first. Were you first?
I don't know.
You can do it if you could take your mask off, Councillor.
Deal.
Moved by Councillor Street, seconded by Councillor Cordova. Councillor Street.
Thank you, Mayor. I'm happy to move the motion. The contents of the report are sufficient explanation for the position of Council. The exclusion of greenhouse gas emissions from concrete used in council construction projects is recognised. I also have to reject the premise of the motion to some extent, in that I don't think what we've created over at Kingston Park is a concrete jungle. In fact, I think we've been quite careful to avoid creating a concrete jungle over there with the extensive open space development that council has undertaken for the community. So I'm happy to support the continuation of a well-established policy, not just in council, or not just in this council, but elsewhere. And like I say, do take issue with the premise of the motion also.
Thank you, Councillor Street. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. The last inventory of Kingborough's greenhouse gas emissions was 2019-2020, and it was a baseline estimate. A baseline estimate for Council's overall emissions profile, including waste, electricity for key buildings and sites, fuel and street lighting. The baseline estimate is not a full carbon footprint, as it doesn't measure every aspect of Council's business. It does, however, capture the largest contributors to emissions. This is important. It does not capture indirect emissions, such as materials used in construction projects like Kingston Park. And I think that's actually really good that we have highlighted that, that we're not yet talking about indirect emissions, but I hope that we do. As it says in 4.4, Council does not currently calculate the greenhouse gas emissions of major projects. My first question is just, please can we elaborate on whether or not that would be a good idea, and what would, I guess, what is stopping Council from incorporating those indirect emissions?
Ms Quinn.
Through you, Mayor. Keeping in mind that I'm very new to this energy emissions space, so forgive me. Obviously, Mr Dool was completely up with it. My understanding of greenhouse gas emissions is that it is extremely complex, and the Australian government have set up quite a complex scenario of who measures what so that we don't double account. So I think I said in the report, so Kingborough could, if it decided to, we could create a figure, but we wouldn't want to do anything with that in terms of national reporting, because it's sort of like double dipping, because that all a lot of those inputs, so the fuel used to get the products to the council site and the cement itself have already been accounted for in that Australian government system of greenhouse gas accounting. So yes, we could do it for interest. It would cost quite a bit to do that, but we could do that. And council certainly move forward on a more annual, an easier annual way of creating an inventory. So you'll be able to see our emissions hopefully on an annual basis in a report card. So it is getting simpler, but if we start to add more projects to that, I guess the flip side of that is we would not only want to look at the emissions, it has to balance out of the input. So, for example, in Kingston Park, it would have to balance that out with all of the landscaping that's been done, so the trees that have been put in that space.
Thank you. And through you, Mayor, that's a critical point there, is that there's these... There's the other side of carbon accounting as well, which is alluded to in 4.8, that council plants 12,000 native plants a year, and all of that would need to be factored in. Again, one of the reasons why I'm so pleased that people bring motions to the AGM is I would like a more robust set of figures about, basically, we've got a baseline now, but that baseline doesn't include some things. But then again, as we've just heard, that we don't want to double dip, as it says in 8.2, it explains it succinctly. In accounting for emissions from concrete installation, council would be doubling up as the emissions from this industry are reported by the industry to the Australian government. So if we count our carbon emissions from concrete, I think we should have an awareness of them, let's be clear about that. But if we then count them, the industry itself is counting them and reporting them to the Australian government, so we shouldn't be counting them twice. But as it says in 6.2, the creation of cement as a critical component of concrete is one of the most important building materials in the modern world, but it is also a leading industrial emitter of carbon dioxide emissions. That's why we should be looking at it. That's why I'm glad that we are talking about it. And I also actually wanted to test the waters, since I'm a mover and a seconder. I would hope that somebody might indulge me. I think council would benefit from having a workshop about not just this specific issue, but about, I guess, our carbon accounting. We had one in 2022 that we now have 40% of our councillors, brand new councillors. So I'd be, if anybody else in their contribution wanted to suggest adding an amendment to this, so it would be A, B, C, D.
Councillor Cordova, because you can't actually, as you're saying, you're part of the team who have moved this, but as I indicated previously, you don't need to move a motion to have a workshop. And we already have, at this stage, our workshop schedule is
full until, when did we decide, end of March. But certainly we can add it onto the list.
Thank you, Mayor. I appreciate that. Nevertheless, I would recommend if anybody wants to put it in writing that we should get a workshop on this. I think it's a very important area. So I guess once again, to conclude my remarks, we're right to be looking at indirect emissions and we're right to be talking about the impact that concrete has. But as Councillor Street mentioned, that's not exactly what's going on at Kingston Park. I mean, I think there's a little bit of hyperbole in the premise of the motion, because I think whilst reasonable people could disagree or agree about the various architecture, the landscaping and things about Kingston Park, I don't think it's necessarily fair to say that it is a concrete jungle. But in amongst that, what's really great about this is that we're now talking about carbon emissions and we're talking about Kingborough's role in reducing our carbon emissions. And so I welcome that, and I really would like a workshop to talk more about how we can make more robust, more transparent and more strategic our carbon accounting systems. I know that we've done some good work in that space and more work to be done. So that's why I'm pleased to be seconding the motion. I think it's always useful to just put it in writing that we will have a workshop on it, although I will also make that suggestion as well offline. So thank you, Mayor.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Any further speakers? Councillor Midgley.
Thank you.
And then Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. I'm just wondering if these sort of discussions and topics are ever raised at LGAT meetings, and if other councils are sort of thinking about their carbon accounting and...
I don't think we've had a motion on this since I've been Mayor, so not in the last 18 months or so that I can recall being on the LGAT agenda.
Thank you.
Councillor Antoli? No? Okay. All right. I'm going to ask Councillor Street if he would like to sum up. And he's going to take his face mask off to do it.
He's going to take his face mask off. Thank you. I don't think there's anything more to say, Mayor.
Thank you very much. I'm going to put the motion then as moved by Councillor Street, seconded by Councillor Cordova. All those in favour? Against? The motion is carried unanimously. It takes us now to page 42, AGM Notice of Motion, A Voice for Multicultural Communities in Kingborough, item 15.8, with a recommendation on page 44. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. I've got a mover in Councillor Cordova and a seconder in Councillor Antoli. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. It's a great privilege to move this motion, and I'm pleased to see that it was roundly supported at the AGM. It's recommended that a multicultural advisory group is convened to engage with the community and develop a multicultural strategy that will be returned to Council for endorsement. This will provide a voice for our multicultural community, as requested in the motion. I think the benefits are self-evident. We're talking about inclusion, we're talking about bringing people on board and being a welcoming place. We're also a very popular place with people who move here and visitors alike, and part of the reason for that is our rich multicultural tapestry. And so I would really welcome this. I think it's a great addition to our to what Council gets involved with, and I really look forward to seeing some of the outcomes, so do keep me posted. I'm very proud and privileged to support this motion.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. Also very great to support this motion, noting that Sejini worked with her when I was at the City of Hobart, attended many events. She's a great advocate in the multicultural women's space, and at the first candidates forum at the Kingston Beach Hall that I attended in 2018, I think it was, Sejini did ask what Kingborough Council was doing in regards to the multicultural community, and I guess I want to publicly apologise that I haven't really moved much on that myself as a councillor, apart from the former Mayor Dean Winter and I meeting with Multicultural Council of Tasmania and looking at the Welcoming Cities project. But it's been great to be a part of Council's sort of, I guess, first, well, Councillor Fox might disagree, might have had other working group similar to this, but since I've been on Council, a working group where I feel like we developed a really great model with the LGBTIQA+, and noting for Council staff, it was quite a robust model in regards to working with the group and how the engagement and consultation was done. My only question is, in 4.4... the last sentence where chaired by councillors, nominations publicly sought from the Tasmanian Aboriginal community, multicultural organisations and members of the community. I'm a bit not the word, not concerned, but just wondering why I've included the Tasmanian Aboriginal community in that, because I would see that the two consultations should be separate, but again, I don't identify as Tasmanian Aboriginal, so interested in that, please.
Dr. Fox.
Thank you for the question, and it's a really good point. In considering this notice of motion, I did do a little bit of looking around at other councils and what they've done, and obviously had some experience in Glenorchy, my former council. What was really clear in Glenorchy and also for other councils is that it's important when you're developing a multicultural strategy to recognise the Aboriginal community as the first culture in our land, and to really make sure that we're recognising that and we're including actions that that acknowledge that throughout the process. So one of the first steps, if this is endorsed by council, will be to have a chat to the local Aboriginal people to see what they would like, how they would like to be engaged and involved in this. If they do not feel that they would like to sit on that committee, no pressure. It's really just to offer our respect and our acknowledgement and to see how they would like to be engaged. It's can be confronting to have a multicultural strategy developed without that engagement and without making sure that we're respecting the Aboriginal people as the original and traditional owners of the land. I don't want to get caught in a situation where we're recognising cultural diversity in the community without that base level of acknowledgement. So certainly happy to engage with the Aboriginal community however they would like to engage. If that is sitting on the group, happy for that. If not, I absolutely respect that as well.
Thank you very much for that explanation. I note that maybe 3 years ago there was discussion around developing a reconciliation plan. I think there was another name, Mayor, I forget. Ms Wilcox, who was a fantastic staff member at the time. There was, but again, and one of the reasons why I guess I didn't progress the idea of engaging and looking at a plan for multicultural community is noting that staff have a lot of workload, and this is significant workload as well, but I have raised the question around the type of a reconciliation plan as well. So perhaps following this, maybe moving forward, and I guess through that engagement with the Tasmanian Aboriginal local community, that could be perhaps something as well to look at if that was a separate action plan to move forward in the future. And I think that would be very worthwhile and of interest as well.
Thank you, Councillor Midgley. Next, I've got Councillor Fox and then Councillor Dean. Councillor Fox.
I guess we haven't ever had a multicultural advisory group, but we have had a very strong influence in multiculturalism in Tasmania, in Kingborough. I personally was aware that the Abel Tasman's birthplace was in Holland, and when the members of the council where he was born came out to Tasmania, it would have been in the early 90s possibly, but 20 years ago I think, a sister city relationship was formed between their council and Kingborough, which as far as I know still exists, but there were regular visits between our countries. And we also had an art prize which involved a competition of high school students, and the winner was chosen to visit the Netherlands, and it was a wonderful experience to visit all the museums over there. But likewise, the winner from Holland on the alternate year would come out, and Kingborough families would host them and take them around our beautiful scenery and countryside, and it was a life-changing experience for all the recipients over the many years. Also, we've had festivals, particularly here in where the council car park now is, was one of the most successful ones, where we had Bollywood dancing and cultural food and entertainment from a whole range of community members from different cultures. And even though it hasn't been formalised up till now, I think we've also had a very strong, good relationship with the Aboriginal community, and especially lately we've had some very exciting events at the Hub. And we're lucky that we've got the Hub now, where we have room for these entertainments, for these cultural events. And I think it's be a really good opportunity to cast our net wider to the more diverse population that is currently coming to Kingborough. When you look at the list of different countries that are being represented in Kingborough, we've got people from the UK, China, New Zealand, South Africa, the Netherlands, United States, Nepal, Germany and Malaysia, and that's just to name a few. So if we could ask them what they would like to do and how they would like to contribute, as well as them being contributing, they're also feeling welcome and being included, and that's part of our policy. So I think it's really important that we support this motion, and I hope it goes well. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Fox. Councillor Dean.
Yeah, like I said before, I think this is brilliant. We all know we live in a multicultural, diverse area, and if we do want to be a modern and inclusive one, then this is exactly is a really good stepping stone towards achieving that and improving on it. Anyone that probably would have, in the recent campaign, done a bit of door knocking would have come across a lot of face-to-face interactions. And one thing that stood out to me, I suppose, is that and I don't want to foreshadow the terms of reference of such a group, but the lack of awareness amongst a big chunk of our community that aren't aware that they have voting rights. And it's not advertised widely by TEC or us itself, but many temporary residents make a large part of the multicultural group, and residents that are really important and play a huge role in our community, that we recognise their importance, whether they're temporary or they're moving on to permanent residency, that is something that we can hopefully build a little bit on and help their engagement, not as just ratepayers or as whatever they do and studying or working in our community, that we also ensure that they have the capacity to vote and be part of our community even more so. Yeah, just want to say that.
Thank you, Councillor Dean. Councillor Midgley.
Question.
Okay, good, excellent. Councillor Midgley on a question.
So will this, and again, I absolutely so support this, but will this be a program that will be supported by the community development, community services staff, and has the number of community services staff declined over the last 4 years in council? And I note that there are a lot of policies and strategies that they are working on. So I'm wondering, do we have enough staff to ensuring that all this fantastic work continues? A few questions in that one.
Dr. Fox.
I couldn't tell you if the number of staff has declined over the last 4 years because I haven't been here quite that long, but certainly it will be undertaken by the community development staff. They do have a massive workload. They're very professional and very capable staff. I'm very proud of that team. They do, as I said, have a massive workload, and this will be another project for them to deliver, and I will obviously assist with that. This is, though, something that they're very passionate about and very interested in. As you mentioned earlier, they're also very interested in a Reconciliation Action Plan or something along those lines, and this wouldn't preclude that work from happening in future. So, yes, to be delivered by that team. Yes, they're an amazing team, and I'm sure they'll get the job done admirably. Yes, we could always use more resources. Sorry.
That's okay. Just a further question. I admire the pitch.
It is great. A further question on that. So if that can be taken on notice in regards to the staffing changes over the last 4 years in that area, and
the Acting General Manager can provide us some assistance.
Through you, Mayor, the baseline number of staff has not declined. However, we do have one staff member on 12 months leave of absence. We have another staff member on an extended period of leave at the moment, and we have one unfilled position. So we've got someone acting in a casual capacity in that position. So at the moment, it may appear as if our staffing numbers are down, but it's only temporary.
Great, thank you. And just a further question on the staff, is that okay if it's not?
Yes.
So previously there was a hub coordinator that also sat in the community services area, but from my understanding we didn't replace that position, but more the services, the workload went to the community services staff, is that correct?
We're starting to get a little bit off track. Can we take that discussion offline? Because I'd like to. We've got a big agenda, and I'm conscious of the time. And Councillor Antoli, do you want to make a contribution?
Yes, I would. I'd love to be able to sum up. Is that the right time
no,
now?
You no, you can't sum up because okay. you didn't move the motion.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry. Jumping in there. Look, as a migrant, I have to support this. This is wonderful. My parents migrated here before I was born. They didn't become naturalised Australians until 1975, so I was about 6 years old. And equally as important, Mrs. Sumar lives across the road from me, so if I don't support this, I might get run over by a car one day. But jokes aside, she's wonderful. She does a great job. I would love to be part of this advisory group if the chance permits. And I really appreciated Dr. Fox's explanation how multiculturalism includes the First Nations. And it's a great way to connect our migrants to the Aboriginal community because they're just not aware through the lack of length of time in the country the way we are, having been brought up here. And I think we're very privileged to have you in charge of the department over this because of your experience at Glenorchy. So I'm really looking forward to some of that expertise. I know Glenorchy is extremely multicultural compared to even us. So, yeah, this is fantastic.
Thank you, Councillor Antoli. Just for my contribution briefly before I hand over to Councillor Cordova to sum up, I fully support this motion. I was very pleased to see Sejini bring it to the AGM. When I first became Mayor last year, 18 months ago, I did talk to her about the possibility of establishing some sort of advisory group for the multicultural community, but it was a question of the resourcing implications on an ongoing basis for our staff, particularly in the community development team, because we do know how hard, incredibly hard they work. And so it seems that we have now found a model that has been very successful with the LGBTIQA plus strategy, and I think that being able to have a well, we called it an advisory group in this case, but to be able to have that and have a participatory voice from a wide-ranging members of our very multicultural community, and one only has to come along to one of our citizenship ceremonies to appreciate the diversity that exists. And sometimes I look at the list and I think, wow, today, you know, for me, as someone who is also the daughter of a migrant, my mother emigrated from Germany in 1959, and I look around and I think, we are very lucky to live in Australia and indeed very lucky to live in Tasmania, so I see it as a privilege to make our residents new citizens, and it amazes me from how many different countries that they come from. And it's not uncommon in one of those ceremonies to have 20 or 30 different countries represented, and I think that says something about the diversity of the community we now live in. And I do hope that through this process that we can develop a range of strategies that we can implement that will make make Kingborough a more welcoming and caring place, and make sure that we do have awareness of voting rights for residents, regardless of the countries they've come from, but that we can actually develop a set of strategies that are really going to send a strong message about we really value people coming from other countries and choosing to live here in Kingborough, because as Councillor Cordova said, it's that rich tapestry, and I use those exact words all the time in the citizenship ceremonies that I have the honour of presiding over. So I look forward to this work progressing. I would be very keen to be part of this group as well. I think it's going to be hotly contested, and I suspect we will be coming to a ballot amongst the councillors, but that's something that we will deal with in the at some stage in the new year. So, Councillor Cordova, would you like to say a few words to sum up?
Thank you, Mayor. It's been a very uplifting and positive discussion, and I'm glad to hear from my council colleagues this overarching support that, if I'm reading the room correctly, I certainly feel it here. And I thank the councillors, but I also, of course, thank Sejini for bringing it to the AGM. And I think it's worth noting that this was wholeheartedly supported on the floor of the AGM as well. So I think we're definitely listening to the community and we're definitely responding accordingly. Over one-fifth of our municipality was born overseas, a higher proportion than the statewide average. And I think this advisory group will give input, it will give representation, and it will raise important issues that relate directly to our strategic plan, 1.2, to be an inclusive community that has a strong sense of pride and local identity. So with that, I wish the advisory group every success, and I thank my councillor colleagues for their contribution. I support the motion.
Thank you very much, Councillor Cordova. So I'm going to move the motion as printed in the agenda and is displayed on the screen. We've got a mover in Councillor Cordova, a seconder in Councillor Antoli. All those in favour? Against? The motion is carried unanimously. It's 7:29pm. I'm going to suggest a short comfort break because I suspect we're going to be here for a while longer. So if we could please be back in here no later than we'll have a 10-minute break. If we could be back in here just before 7:40 to start right on 7:40, that would be appreciated and ensure that we're not here any later this evening than we need to be. So for those who are watching at home, we'll just have a 10-minute break and be back with you. That looks good. 7:40. Well done. Okay. Welcome back to the meeting. Acting General Manager, could you just confirm that the recording has recommenced?
Confirmed.
Thank you to those people who have been watching along at home. We appreciate your patience while we just refresh ourselves because we've still got a fair bit to get through on the agenda. So we are now on page 45, Council Meetings and Councillor Workshops Audio Recording Guideline Policy, with a recommendation on page 47. So I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. Moved Councillor Street, seconded Councillor Cordova. Councillor Street without his mask.
Thank you, Mayor. I remembered that time. It seems hard to believe now that there was a time when council meetings weren't recorded. That's been the case for 10 years or more now, and council workshops have been recorded in more recent times. Both policies have proven very useful, both in the dissemination of what happens at open council meetings and also the ability for councillors and staff to go back and review what's been said in those meetings and in workshops to clarify matters and also where there's been matters of dispute to be able to refer back to those recordings has been very useful. I think one of the subsidiary benefits of recording as well, especially the recording of workshops while they're not publicly available, that has been quite useful. Is that it has had a tendency to moderate behaviour as well. The knowledge that people are being recorded has often had that beneficial effect. The updated policy only has a few amendments. Most of those are to do with the inclusion of councillor workshops, which, while they are in a separate policy, they do refer back to this policy, so I agree that it makes sense to refer to workshops in this one. I thank staff for those amendments and for putting the motion to council, and I commend the recommended motion.
Thank you, Councillor Street. Further discussion? Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. And as Councillor Street pointed out, there are just minor amendments to the policy, and I think they are all good ones, particularly 4.2 that now recognises the scope has been broadened to recognise that sometimes under special circumstances, council meetings and council workshops may use online collaboration tools, and so that's a good thing. I think that the key point here for me is in 7.1 under communication and consultation that in addition to the live streaming of council meetings, making available the audio recording of an open session of council meetings provides the community with another means of accessing meeting contents and debates. And the reason for me that this is the key is that we're trying to increase the transparency, we're trying to increase people's engagement with council, and because council is the closest point to the community, in fact, the more that people engage with their local council, the more they'll understand and see the amazing things that are going on, but also because the community is our eyes and ears, the more that we engage with the community, when there are things that go wrong out in the community, we can fix those faster. So I really do encourage people, you know, whenever I talk to people, I encourage them to get involved with the council, watch the meetings, come along and attend, ask some questions, move a motion at the AGM, and I think by having these extra options when it comes to audio recording of council meetings, it just helps facilitate that community engagement, which is a good thing. It's important to point out the risks that are highlighted at 8.1 and 8.2. I think something that I've talked about when it comes to the local government review is the fact that there is no parliamentary privilege in this place, that we, unlike the parliament, are subject to consequences for matters when we talk about things that might be regarded as offensive or defamatory. But conversely, by having that audio recording, it provides a mechanism to establish what was actually said in an accurate way at a council meeting. So I think the minor amendments are good and they make sense, and I support the policy. Thank you.
Thank you. Councillor Cordova. Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. I have a question. So we currently have, of course, YouTube recordings that go back quite a number of years, I think 2, 3, something like that years, but the audio recordings are only kept up to 6 months. Is there an inconsistency in that? Can someone just clarify? Will that mean that the YouTubes will be removed if they're over 6 months? It doesn't affect them? So we've got sort of two formats out there. One, we seem to put a time limit on. There are certain risks around why we're doing that. But the YouTubes, we don't. And to me, is there the same sort of risk? I'm not sure. Just a clarification for me.
The Acting General Manager, could you please assist us?
Through you, Mayor, for consistency, it would be desirable to bring those two into line. So I can certainly raise that point with the Chief Information Officer.
Anything further, Councillor Antoli?
I suppose I'm just thinking on the spot, forgive me. I don't know how that works in terms of, I hear you, I think it should be consistent. So the question is for the council to maybe discuss is up to 6 months too little?
I think it's the requirement of the Act is, the Local Government Act is a minimum of 6 months.
Minimum.
I believe, is that correct, Acting General Manager? Yep.
Did this not say up to 6 months?
At least.
Not sorry, less, not thank less you.
Okay, sorry, not less.
Not less. Yeah. That's an important distinction. Yeah, sorry, that's fine.
Beg your pardon.
Yeah.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. My question, to follow up on that, because it's a really good point, is that I had kind of highlighted 3.2A, which says retained by council for at least 6 months. My question is, why wouldn't we amend that in the policy to be, for example, in perpetuity or 7 years as per financial stuff? Why, you know, 6 months, of course, is the bare minimum as set out in the Act, but I wouldn't mind enshrining in our policy, just to kind of make it a bit more concrete, that we have an intention to keep it for quite a long time so that people, for posterity, can, for the fullness of time, go back and see what was said and get an accurate reflection of the dynamics in the room. I think that's all important stuff for history, really.
I'm going to...
Yeah, my question was, is there a reason that it's only 6 months, not in perpetuity?
Acting General Manager.
Through you, Mayor, the only reason would be one of storage, which, you know, these days with the cloud is... I mean, obviously, audio recordings take up significant amount of storage space, but, you know, that's no longer an issue these days. So, if you wanted to make that amendment to require it to be kept longer, I don't have an issue with that.
There is also an anomaly here that the at 5.1, the closed session has to be kept unmodified for 12 months, but the open session only has to be kept for not less than 6 months. So that's another anomaly. Councillor Fox, you had your light on, and then Councillor Street. You moved. Okay, you've got a question.
I have just got a question. I understood that the audio recording was kept forever, but maybe I'm confused with the web page, that the minutes and the agendas are kept on there for a lot longer. I know that's off topic slightly, but at least the record of the decisions we make, which is probably more important, are kept in writing on... Are they kept in writing on our... web page?
Acting General Manager.
Through you, Mayor. Certainly our web archive of council agendas and minutes and audio recordings. I think goes back at least 2 years. Mrs. Morton might correct me if I'm wrong on that, but she's saying 5 years. So certainly whilst the policy is saying no less than 6 months, the practice is to keep it significantly longer than that and keep it available to the public significantly longer.
Councillor Street with a question.
Thank you, Mayor. I might have misunderstood Councillor Cordova and Councillor Antoli's concerns, but could Mr. Smee just confirm that 5.9 does actually say that a compressed version of the original audio recording of the open session of the meeting shall be created and made accessible from Council's website and also archived in Council's record-keeping system as the authoritative published version? And that would indicate to me that that would be in perpetuity.
Mr. Smee.
Through you, Mayor, we do indeed keep a copy in perpetuity. There's a distinction between what we make publicly available on a day-to-day basis and what we keep stored in perpetuity.
So we've got it forever if somebody wants to go back.
Yes.
But,
which they can by request in writing to the General Manager.
Yeah.
Okay, do I have any further speakers? If not, I'll ask Councillor Street, did you want to sum up? No, he's indicated he does not, so I'll put the motion. It's as moved by Councillor Street, seconded by Councillor Cordova, that the Council Meetings and Council Workshops Audio Recording Guidelines Policy 1.1 be approved. All those in favour? Against? The motion is carried unanimously. We now move to page 55 of the financial report for November 2022 with a recommendation on page 56. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. Can move, Councillor Gladewright. Seconded, Councillor Cordova. Councillor Gladewright.
So moved. I'm not sure if there's much more to discuss since we already looked at the five-month review, but happy to hear what other people have to say.
Any? Councillor Cordova.
Thanks. Just to make the point that, so we already spoke about inflation, we spoke about the rain events, particularly materials and services here are $160,000 over budget, primarily due to expenditure on unsealed roads as a result of rain damage over the past 4 months. And of course, the cost of fuel is getting higher. Am I correct that our deficit equates to, it's like less than 1%. I don't have it in front of me, but I think it was like 0.6%. It's a $129,000 deficit over about $20.58 million. So I guess, Dorothy Dixer aside, this is kind of a question that is it true that we are in fact in a relatively okay position for where we are in the year and in the long term? What's the analysis of our risk?
Mr. Breen.
Yes, through you, Mayor. Yeah, look, essentially I see this as pretty well a break-even year. We're break-even, we're on the positive side. This, with these changes, probably a bit on the negative side. As I did indicate in the report, there is one big unknown, and that's our return from Southern Waste Solutions. The last couple of years we've been receiving around $200,000 to $300,000 coming back from that particular organisation. Unfortunately, they don't budget for much in the way of a surplus, but if that return continues on, then we've still got a chance of making a surplus. But you're correct, it's really a pretty close to break-even result for us.
Thank you. Through you, Mayor, that's really helpful. A slightly positive, in among all the, I guess, hurt within the community as a result of interest rates rising, it's worth noting that Council's interest income is $142,000 over budget due to recent increases in interest rates producing additional interest income. My question around that is, do we make forecasts and predictions around the volatility in interest rates? And if so, do we anticipate that over the next, you know, between now and 2025, that we can see that aspect of the ledger continue to increase over time?
Mr. Breen.
Through you, Mayor. So yes, when we do the long-term financial plan, we do an analysis going out for that 10-year period. So as part of that, we'll have a look at interest rates, and certainly the expectations of the next at least 2 or 3 years, they will be slightly elevated. But when inflation returns back to that sort of 2.5% range, we might see interest rates come back down. But certainly our expectation is that the return over the next 2 or 3 years will be fairly significant.
Thank you. And just to conclude my remarks, Mayor, it's best said at 8.1 that the result for November is slightly below the budget expectations and does not present a significant financial risk to Council. And it also mentions throughout the report, you know, for example, with grants capital being over budget, that's because in October Council received $326,000 in capital grants, made up of $100,000 for the Woodbridge footpath and $175,000 for the Kingston Beach boat ramp and breakwater upgrade. So it's good to see where our finances are and have a quick health check, but it's also good to see that the actual real-time implications of these financial decisions that we're making result in improved services to the residents of Kingborough, and that's ultimately what it's all about. So I'm very pleased to have seconded this motion. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Next, I've got Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. Just a question around the user fees being over at the hub, which is great, but for speculating for the future, was that related to the vaccination clinics being there?
Mr. Breen.
Yes, through you, Mayor. Yes, so essentially that was I guess at the start of this financial year, we had some vaccination clinics there, which certainly gave us a bit of a boost. However, my understanding is... Sorry, apologies. my understanding is, though, that we've been fairly successful in regards to generating activity over there. So you know, we'll have a good chance next year to have a bit of a look at what that sort of income will be on an ongoing basis.
Great, thank you. And I always ask this question, but I just can't see where it is. So the land sales at Kingston Park, noting that was a big part of paying off the amount that was borrowed, was subject, like, I mean, the land sales were going to have a big impact on that. Can you point me as to where we have received income from the land sales at Kingston Park, and are we on track for that? Like, when we first did that development there, we had a bit of an idea of when we would receive money. Are we on track?
Mr. Breen.
Yeah, through you, Mayor. So essentially the land sales won't appear in our operational statement because they are effectively a capital return based on the land we have over there. So we haven't received anything this financial year. The funds we got was last financial year. We have received some minor amounts this financial year, I should say, because we have the land sale and then we get a percentage of revenue. So it's only the percentage of revenue that we've had this year, so it's fairly minor in nature. Sorry, I should correct that. There is an amount of around about $150,000 that sits in our other income because it was additional funds received for the sale of land. But we actually take that out of the underlying surplus calculation because it's not considered part of our underlying result when we do our financial results at the end of the year. So that proportion is in there. Normally it's just a retirement of a previous capital item, but that one is in there because of additional funds after we recognise the sale of the land.
Happy, Councillor Midgley? Yes? Yep. Any further contributions? Councillor Gladewright, did you want to sum up? No. Okay, I'm going to put the motion that Council endorses the attached financial report as at 30th of November 2022, moved by Councillor Gladewright, seconded by Councillor Cordova. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried unanimously. Takes us to page 76, notices of motion. At the time the agenda was compiled, there were no notices of motion received. We now go to confirmation of items to be dealt with in closed session. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder that in accordance with Regulation 15 of the Local Government Meeting Procedures Regulations 2015, Council by absolute majority move into closed session to consider the following items: confirmation of minutes, applications for leave of absence, tender assessment TS2848, Kingston Beach Breakwater, tender assessment AB2212, Channel Highway Reconstruction, and also Agenda Item 15.2 that was moved from open into closed session. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder. I've got a mover in Councillor Gladewright and a seconder in Councillor Antoli. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? The motion is carried. So thank you very much to those people who were with us this evening, who have now since departed, but also to the many people who have been watching along at home via YouTube. This is the last council meeting for the year. The next meeting will take place on Monday the 16th of January, and we look forward to you all being able to watch that. And on behalf of all of Kingborough Council, I would like to wish our members of our community a very happy and a safe Christmas and New Year, and I think importantly I'd like to know that people can spend time where possible with their loved ones. And if I can share with you an analogy of what I said about my recent holiday when I took some leave, and people said, "How was your holiday?" And I said, "I have come back heavier in body but lighter in mind." So I wish that means it is the ultimate holiday break, and I wish that everybody in our community gets to have that sort of break over the festive season with their loved ones. So very Merry Christmas to you all, and thank you very much. And in accordance with the Kingborough Council Meetings Audio Recording Guidelines Policy, the open session of the meeting will now cease.